This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, West Bow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book deals with an important topic, and the title is Homeless, I Have Known. And my author who joins me from Indiana is author Muriel Drake Ryan. Dr. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Welcome, Jay, and just call me Muriel.
All right, I'm happy to do so. Your book is a relatively short read. You have an extensive background dealing with this issue. Share with the audience a little of that background and what the impetus was behind your sharing these stories and getting this book to press.
I spent many of my professional years as an educator and working with families and working with the idea of collaborative learning. And then just before I totally retired, I did a guest professorship at St. Mary's College here in Terre Haute. And then I moved from there to working with the issue of poverty. My last semester, I taught a class that introduced me to Ruby Payne's book on poverty. And I worked with during the summer, but then I realized that there were people that we couldn't just treat out of a storefront ministry. We needed to end up having some place for them to live. Mm. And that's where Families by Choice came from.
When you say someplace to live, did you establish a large dwelling for people who are street people, or was it a individual residences? How did that come about?
We went with large houses here in Terre Haute. Terre Haute has a number of historic large houses. We have a men's shelter called Timothy's House, a women's shelter called Deborah's House, which was the first one we opened. And then about 5 years ago, we discovered that there were some parents that felt that they just couldn't deal with the issues of autism, and they would literally put these kids on the street, or the kids would, in frustration, run away.
Wow.
And so we established what we call Project Jonathan, which works with the mentally challenged.
I have a brother-in-law who is emotionally and mentally challenged, but he's very bright in many ways, and he lives with us and actually is a wonderful addition to our family. He's just loaded with, to some it'd be useless information. He has a lot of detail. He's a detailed personality, but he is actually a treasure to have around. We enjoy his living with us. There are some other issues that happen on the streets in Texas, where I'm located. We see many people who are taking on the robe, if I may use that term, of homelessness and begging on the streets. And yet there is a question mark about some of these individuals. It doesn't appear that they are incapacitated either intellectually or physically. There seems to be a method of using homelessness to maybe deceive the public. That is causing a negative impact on the people who really have needs, is it not?
Yes, yes. And frankly, we've come up with a method to curb that. We have wristbands that have the name of our organization on them as well as a telephone number.
Fabulous.
And we encourage people to put them in their wallet, in their purse, or wear them on their wrist and give that away. And I will say, we will screen them. If they really need help, they need food, they need resources, we know our community, we know where we can direct them if they really have a need, but we will screen them. And if you look in your rearview mirror and they've thrown this thing over their shoulder after you gave it to them, mm-hmm. then you did not find someone who had a real need.
Absolutely.
If they had a real need, they'd use that, because most of them could get a cell phone. Most of them will be able to get a cell phone through having food stamps. And so they can call us. And we will screen them, and we will hook them up with the right resources. So that's one of the things that we've done. We have a Walmart that's famous for having people standing with cardboard signs as you exit. We've got a Highway 70 interstate that many people will find folks standing there as they get off the highway and come into Terre Haute, and they're standing there with a sign. We will screen them. We will make sure that only those that have a real need will get the services.
You're doing something on a community level that is traceable, trackable, and commendable, of course. in my community. How does one go about finding a way to assist these individuals that really have needs and are desperate for help?
I would actually start with finding through your government a homeless coalition. HUD has an expectation that there will be an effort to deal with a lack of affordable housing. And so they have a requirement that you have a homeless coalition or a coalition of folks that are dealing with folks that are lacking housing or are finding it difficult to find affordable housing. So each government center should have, under community development, should have a committee of this sort. In each state, each one of our 50 states. But I would find those folks that have an organization, that have a shelter for the homeless, and get to know them very well. Have them out to your church. Find out what their major challenges are. Now, we're in a situation where we established a program that would not allow us to get any government money whatsoever.
That's a different approach, and probably some serious reasons behind that from a personnel standpoint. You have outlined several personal stories in here of individuals who are in that difficult period of homelessness. Have you come across individuals who are highly educated that either through emotional distress or some other factor have ended up on the streets?
Yes, we found people that are very articulate and have a wide vocabulary and a good work experience that somehow just cannot connect with the world or got disconnected from a large corporation. Normally, they don't stay for the duration of our program that now lasts for a year, but we do find that every person that comes in, no matter what their status is, whether they have a learning disability, a mental health issue, or have been very sophisticated in their life, the short story is they're almost always to a person come in very depressed, feeling very unworthy because they've reached a point in life where they don't have the resources to put a roof over their head.
Incredibly difficult.
We work hard to make sure that that's one of the first things we deal with, is their sense of non-worth.
In reading your book, what is the reader going to find besides the general story of individuals? Is there one or two people that really made an impact and caused your ministry to go forward?
I would say that it wasn't one or two. It was a continued repetition of often the same problem, and that has to do with a general sense of not feeling like they're part of a family, a general sense of not feeling like they belong, frustration with whatever is necessary to move forward and make choices. I can't think of one or two other than the fact that I do recall the gentleman that I do tell a story of that he always apologized. He had had a very fitful youth and he was in his early 40s and he looked at me one day and apologized again for something that was not his fault. And I turned around on my heel and I said, "I love you because God loved you first." And I'm going to let the readers find out what happened next.
Wow. Well, I'm ready to find out myself. I was going, "Wow, this is a cliffhanger. I know it's going to be good." You have also mentioned that you have homes for ladies or women who are going through distress and difficult times. Is there a preponderance of that comes from domestic abuse, or is it just circumstantial evidence or circumstantial things, maybe from addiction or maybe from self-esteem issues that are causing them to be in this situation?
I think it's a little bit of everything that you just listed. I will be truthful to the fact that the first five, I learned really quickly, the first five women we served, four out of the first five had been raped before they were 16.
Wow.
A different four out of the first five had been in foster care. And the complexity of being second generation of not knowing how to parent correctly is probably the thing that let us know right away that we were on the right track, that teaching them how to parent and teaching them how to be part of a cohesive group that loved and cared one another and counted on one another was critical. One word that we had to drop from our vocabulary almost entirely was the word father. And so we began to approach the gospel from the values that are taught in Galatians 5, the gifts of the Spirit, and then also to take a look at those things that Paul refers to in Philippians, the things that we should think upon. And so we looked at those values and we built from there. And but father was something that could literally bring out hives. Wow. And because there had been such traumatic, either from biological or stepfather or whatever. And so not understanding how to respect oneself and one's body was a concern that had to be dealt with. And valuing them as people.
You deal with a very important, prejudice by many people that these individuals on the street that we see, especially because I think of the difficulty we have with individuals holding signs and begging, that they're just stinkers. They just don't really care about themselves or other people. They're out for selfish reasons. But that's not the case, and those stories come through in the book that you have written.
Well, and I think that's really critical, and that was part of the reason the book was written, was to end up kicking those stereotypes out the door and recognizing the fact that there were people below that level of what they were seeing that are in desperate straits. And we need to recognize the fact that they're not all stinkers. There are stinkers. I write a whole chapter called Stinkers, and they exist. We have no tolerance for their behaviors. We have no tolerance for alcohol. We do collaborate with things like Celebrate Recovery Organizations, the AA, and we encourage them to cling to their sobriety. And one of our rules in the house is no drinking, no drugs, because a sober mind makes better decisions.
Beautiful. You have some wonderful concepts in here, but I think the most compelling thing about your book is, first of all, it's a relatively short read. You didn't want to get people bogged down into the negative side of what's happening on the street, I'm guessing. But also, you give some positive solutions, and that is to be commended.
Well, I appreciate that very much. One of the reasons that I wrote the book is, besides the fact that it is our 10th year and we're celebrating 10 years, but we're up against the wall financially, and we need some assistance. But at the same time, I wanted people to have a tool in a community that was about the size of Terre Haute. We've got about 65,000 people here, and spill over from the other counties that do not have. Our area has about 150,000, and we're just one part of dealing with the homeless here in Terre Haute. But at the same time, we're looking at the fact that if we had a bed for each homeless person, and we filled them all, the ones that we have, we would still be 252 beds short. Wow. So we still have 252 people to get off the streets and to end up giving them a sense that we will respect them if they come off the streets. So there's a lot of work yet to be done.
You're doing a wonderful gift to them as individuals, as humans, and as people, and as community members. Your organization, I would certainly recommend people get acquainted with it, is titled Families by Choice. Your book here is titled Homeless, I Have Known, and my author, Dr. Muriel Drake Ryan. Where do we get copies of your book, and how do we get involved with what you're doing?
Well, you can get copies of the book from Amazon, Books a Million, and Barnes & Noble online. You can end up writing to me at 164 Allendale Court, Terre Haute, Indiana, 478-4702. We would appreciate it if you do write us that you throw in a $10 bill, and I'll put a book in the mail to you. The short story is that we want to get the word out. We want to end up spreading the word that the homeless are people. They are human beings that have fallen on hard times. And yes, there are seekers. And if they're not ready to be served, they're not ready to comply in a reasonable situation, we don't force anything upon them, even our gospel. We end up saying that that's something that each person should end up choosing a church or a house of worship to develop strength. And that's what we encourage. We do not compel them to attend. But we can get the books out to anyone. And I'd be more than happy to end up taking invitations from Illinois and Ohio, Michigan, to come and speak to churches. We have a problem, and as a society and as Christians, we need to remember that Christ told us to take the stranger in.
Thank you for sharing not only this message but the gospel with those in need, and absolutely demonstrating by action what the gospel is all about. Thank you again for sharing your story. The title of the book, again, is Homeless I Have Known, my author guest, Dr. Muriel Drake Ryan, and my assumption is that you take a gift higher than $10 for the book, should they write you. So we'd love to see that take place, and please keep in touch and let us know how things are going.
Oh, I would greatly appreciate that. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Just one more thing.
Sure.
This book will have, about a year from now, we'll have a companion Bible study book that goes with it. It'll be entitled Taking the Stranger In, and so the churches can end up using it with Sunday school classes or for adult vacation Bible school.
Fantastic.
So we have the two books for people to read, and making sure that the resources go back into the ministry.
Thank you again for sharing that. For Indie Book Publishing, West Bow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us, because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book title, Sacred Spaces, Inspired Living. And joining me from Florida is designer and author, B. Pila. Thank you for joining me today, B.
Thank you, Jay. I'm really excited about this.
It's a beautiful book, just from a visual standpoint, 240 pages, but what would you expect other than that from a designer? How long have you been a designer, and what was the reason you decided to share your talent this way?
Well, I've been a designer for over 3 decades. It's hard to believe that I've been doing this for so long. And the reason that I wrote the book, Sacred Spaces for Inspired Living, is because I realized after these many years of creating interior design for so many different people and clients, that at the core of what I did, unlike what's happening in the world out there, that we're so exposed to interior design in so many different ways through the internet, through shows on TV, et cetera, that people were getting a misconception that style is the main focus of what interior design is. And that my philosophy was incongruent with that. So in essence, I had to write the book for myself.
It is beautifully done, colorful, and certainly informative as well. Mm-hmm. Did you personally have a hand in the design and layout of the book?
Yes, I was blessed to work with my daughter to create the book. My daughter is a very talented graphic artist as well as fine artist, and we work together. We've been working together for over 5 years, creating a furniture collection. And by default, after I wrote the book, which took me about a year to do, I knew that it wasn't going to be the typical coffee table book with a bunch of pretty pictures and a few captions to enhance the description of the styles. That wasn't what it was about at all. In fact, what I wanted was to inspire a movement towards soulful interior design, and that there wasn't anything like this out there. So I had to create I call it a hybrid, actually. My publisher, it's kind of like a cookbook, textbook, beauty book, journal, all rolled up into one. And it takes you on this 7-step journey towards design enlightenment.
And you've managed to do that in 240 pages, beautifully done again. If you wanted to, I mean, just from a personal standpoint, if I wanted to put it on my coffee table and just stare at it, I certainly would enjoy that process as well. One of the chapters, though, that is, I think, possibly the foundation of most designing, and maybe for environmental enjoyment, is the chapter 3, Dreaming and Exploring Color. What is your philosophy there on the dreaming side?
You know, it's funny because through those 7 steps, the 3rd step is a beautiful step. Dreaming is one of the first steps because I do believe wholeheartedly that our thoughts create our things. And, you know, when we start with a thought, we start with a dream, especially when we're dreaming about interiors and beautiful environments that influence us every day. I believe that, you know, design has the ability and power to transform our lives, and beauty is such a big aspect of that. So I challenge you to dream and dream big, because it all starts with a dream. And the first 3 steps of my process are the ones that I believe are missing in the process of typical creation of interior design. And I'm so glad that you mentioned it, because without those first 3 steps, we don't even know where to begin. We're just coming from the outside in.
What is the discovery process? Are you discovering things about your own personality and what you enjoy, or is it discovering your space and how to approach it?
Absolutely. We start from within. In fact, I say that we have to come into our interior in order to create our interiors. So the discovery process is a very personal and internal process that I help you do through the help of a questionnaire. I ask you many questions that you that hopefully will inspire you to answer them from a deeper place. And allow you to discover through that question what it is that you really, really want and what it is that makes you happy in order to make that manifest into the things that surround you in your home.
The thing also that is important is Chapter 4, and something that many of us, especially if we're in relationships, have difficulty with, and that's permission granted. I may want a pink wall, and my wife may want an orange wall. How do you meld those two different ideas and concepts together?
You know, that's a great step. Permission granted, I call it that, because I want people to think what I call thinking outside the room. You know, a lot of times, you know, we're handed a house, or we're going, either whether it's a rental or it's our own, and almost the spaces are dictated by whoever created it originally, not necessarily answering the calling of what we want those rooms and spaces to be. So I challenge you to think outside the room. I say, well, if you need an office and you never sit in your dining room, why is it that you must make this room into a dining room if you have another place to sit and eat that you feel great in? So thinking outside the room allows you to be given, you know, as a designer, you know, maybe it's like designer blasphemy. you know, for me to tell you to use your dining room as an office. But I believe that we should be fulfilled by our spaces and that they should serve us and not necessarily the other way around. That's like, what I call permission.
The sacred spaces, where did that come from and what are you referring to?
You know, that title happened so organically and naturally, and ironically, it came out of a retreat that I took that was strictly for business. And the question that I was asked as an interior designer, as a human being, actually, I was asked a very simple question that I guess we all at some point ask ourselves, and that is, what is my purpose? And after about 30 minutes of writing silly things down, like I create beautiful spaces and interiors for people that can afford me, blah, 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 I was like, this is for the birds. This is not what I do. And all of a sudden, I got the words that said, I create sacred spaces so that people can live inspired lives.
Wow.
And to this day, I can't say that phrase without getting goosebumps all over my body and knowing that that's really what I'm all about.
Wow, that could be a great title for a book. complicated part of most individuals' lives, if finances are not an issue, I guess some of my issues as far as decorating could be resolved. It's accumulating stuff. I have had lots of opportunity to do so, and I don't know how to keep it organized or in a venue or environment that is pleasant and sacred. Have you approached that in the book?
Yes, actually, you know, in the last chapter in which I call it, you know, beautifying the space, I make sure that I give you tips and abilities to discern what is important to you. Throughout the book, I ask the question that I feel is the most predominant question that we must ask ourselves throughout any process, whether we're creating anew or whether we declutter a space so that we can appreciate the beauty of other things. And that is, how does this make you feel? Oftentimes, we don't stop and pause to reflect how something makes us feel. And as we acquire things through our lives, we often just acquire them for whatever reason. As we go along, sometimes it might be a functional need. Sometimes it might be just something that was impulsive. But at the end of the day, if we ask ourselves the question, how does this make me feel? If the answer comes in as, I could do without it. What the heck? I don't even know where I got it from. Then it's got to go, because the core of what surrounds us should inspire us. It should always offer a smile and a feeling of happiness and joy. And if it's not doing that, then there's something wrong with that picture.
The readers that you have envisioned in your mind in creating the space for them to read this book, is there a specific reader? Do you have to have large space in order to create the environment that's ideal? Or have you also given tips for the simple person like me that has small space?
You know, it's beautiful that you asked that question, because truly it doesn't have anything to do with size and scale. I have created sacred environments for people that have 20,000 square feet, and I have created them for people that have 500 square feet. It's really about what makes you feel good. And the smaller the space, actually, sometimes the more effective and compact each object that occupies that space needs to be. So sometimes those smaller spaces are the most inspiring, because they have to be multifunctional. They have to provide you with numerous activities that go on within a space. And I find those to be the most amazing of all, because when you have lots of space, you have a tendency to say, well, I'll do that over there in that room, and then I'll do this over there in that room. But when you have a small space, you really have to get to the core of what your life is. Offer the furnishings and objects that support that.
Take a moment and talk to my listeners and explain to them why they should get a copy of this book and what they will achieve by reading it.
Well, I know that from the people that have had the blessing of reading it and the people that have actually gone through this process with me, I know that they have had aha moments from the get-go. Just from the first chapter, they begin to transform their minds into the options of what is it that is my lifestyle? Who am I? And how am I going to want to feel in these spaces versus coming from something that is just outside of ourselves and saying, oh, I like that style. That's a pretty room. But whether that room really is going to be a representation of who they are. So it's a very internal, spiritual, and sacred process that I take you through. And I guarantee that I make it fun, too, because I like to play in all my rooms.
It's a beautiful book. Your daughter is an exceptionally talented visual artist. There's sketches, there are diagrams, there's bright colors that invigorate your thinking process and your mind and your emotions. Wonderfully done. The book is 240 pages, and it's an easy read. I guess it also could be looked at as a reference book for later.
Yes. In fact, I encourage you to write in it. There's pages in which I ask you to pause, reflect, and write, and that's why I wrote it. Not only our publisher produced it, we went through numerous versions of paper type so that we could make sure that people would not feel intimidated by writing in it and keeping it for the duration. But if you're more digitally oriented, of course, you can download it. You can download parts of the chapters. In fact, if you go to my website, sacredspacesliving.com, you're able to download your first chapter for free and give it a shot and see how you feel when you start writing that first discovery questionnaire. So I am the type of person that not only do I believe that every room should be used, every object should be admired, loved, and enjoyed, but the same thing goes for my book. It's a process to be used. It's not just a coffee table book, although it is, like you say, beautiful to look at because it is colorful and invigorating, but it's meant to be used as a process as well. And I didn't want anything about it to feel intimidating.
The title of the book again is Sacred Spaces, Inspired for Inspired Living, Your Guide to Design Enlightenment. B, where do my listeners get a copy of your book?
I can definitely guide them along through my website, but they can also are encouraged to go to Balboa Press or to Amazon or to Barnes & Noble. It's available there, and it's also in some local bookstores. If you happen to live in Miami, it's at Books & Books, which is an iconic bookstore here in Miami. So it's very easily found.
Thank you for sharing your story today. And this is, again, a beautiful book, one to excite the senses and give you great ideas if you're into maybe cleaning up your space and giving it some inspiration at the same time. Again, the title, Sacred Spaces for Inspired Living, Your Guide to Design Enlightenment. My guest, B. Pila. B is spelled B-E-A and last name P-I-L-A. Thank you, B, for joining me today. And I'm assuming from just looking at the style of this book and your energy, there may be something coming along in the future. Is that a possibility?
Well, I do have some things in the works. I've been writing periodically regarding specifics on people that have requested things of me, and I hope maybe it'll be something like Chicken Soup for the Soul, in which specific situations that arise, like empty nesters, or like that people have gotten divorced, or when their children, or when they have a newborn. I'm hoping to answer to the calling of all of those specific spaces because I have had that request. So I've been writing along that line, and hopefully there'll be more to come.
Look forward to talking with you in the future. Thank you, B, for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Jay. It's been such a pleasure.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today we have a very interesting topic that has something to do with college, Bermuda shorts, and maybe even underwear. I don't know why that all fits in, but it's part of the package of a wonderful and entertaining series of stories included in the beautifully illustrated collection, Molly McDougal, Montgomery McGrath, and Other Stories to Make You Laugh. Joining me from I think it's Baltimore, Maryland, is our author.
That's correct, Jay.
George Cooper. Thanks, George, for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
What's the significance of underwear? Well, we know the significance of underwear in some people's worlds, but in yours it had a particular significance related to this book, this novel, this series of stories you wrote.
Well, not so much underwear, but Bermuda shorts. I wrote in response to my mother gave my brother and I, who's 4 years younger than me, a pair of matching Madras beach shirts with no collar and white piping, and she told us to walk around the neighborhood and show all the neighbors our new outfits.
All right.
And I wasn't very enthusiastic about it, and she let me know it. So that was the basis of Bermuda shorts. And it's funny, when my mother read the story that I wrote many years later, she said, this is about those Bermuda shorts, isn't it? And I didn't say anything. I didn't want to hurt her feelings, but she knew what the story was.
Sure. Did you always have, an obtuse or a unique outlook on life? This obviously is a part of your package, maybe.
I like to think so. I think that life without humor is rather difficult. So I try to find humor in as many situations as I can. And usually I'm able to do it. Every once in a while I can't, but I find it makes life more livable.
Well, the foundation of your book and the idea to write this I'll call it a novel, it's really kind of a series of short stories.
It's a series of short stories, right?
Right. It really started in college. In college, you were involved in media also. How did that
That's
lay a
correct.
Foundation for you?
Well, I ended up in the optical business, so that... I guess that'll give you an indication
mm-hmm.
of how well the major worked out for me. But it was something I enjoyed, and I did write a few things in college that the other students seemed to appreciate it. And Molly McDougal was one of those things that I wrote, and I put the story in a dresser drawer. And many, many years later, I happened to notice it, and I thought, oh, this is pretty good, but it really needs some editing. So I decided to edit it and see if I could make it come out all right. And the editing seemed to make the difference between something written by a 20-year-old and something written by a 45-year-old is, I guess, just like anything in life, quite different.
Different perspective,
but,
obviously.
But I had fun with it and decided to see where it would go.
Are you still in? You're not in media. I thought by reading your notes that you were retired. Are you retired or are you?
I am retired.
You are retired.
I am retired, and That's part of my my code for enjoying your life is to retire, no matter what the age, whether you're 7 or 8 years old and you've had enough of grammar school, or you're closing in on 70 like me and you just want to take life easy. Retirement is the key.
I guess the significance of your story is that if you have a desire to be an author, to write, or whatever your passion is in life, don't give up on it and keep those stories sitting around. Maybe it'll come into importance later in life.
Yes, it has been fun. Just writing the stories, you know, keeps me off the street, keeps me from falling in with the wrong crowd, and I find relaxing and very enjoyable at the same time.
It's over 102 pages, and to describe it for our listeners, the illustrations are spectacular. Who is your target audience with this series of novels, or series of stories, I'm sorry?
Well, I would say the real target audience is 7 to 9, but children at a younger age enjoy the artwork, even if they don't always get the stories. And I guess starting at about 4, they seem to start to understand the stories, but sometimes 4 and younger, they really don't understand it, but they can still enjoy the artwork. But I would say if there's a real age that I had in mind is probably 7 to 9.
And you have written in poetry, I would call it, I guess. How in the world did that happen? You have obviously some skills that were not evident in your earlier career.
Well, yes, I did write it in verse, and it's just something I feel comfortable in, and I think that the language of verse is kind of easy on the ears. Especially for children, and they're drawn to it. So since I felt comfortable writing in verse, I thought, well, we might as well give it a shot and see how it goes. And I've gotten a good response in general, but the children in particular seem to enjoy the verse.
Any children or grandchildren stimulate your desire to get this published?
Yes, my granddaughter came along, and you know, and I started to think about the book again. She's 15 now, so she's a little bit older, but yeah, she was kind of my motivation to get the process rolling again, to see if I could do something with my stories.
Is your main character Molly McDougall Montgomery McGrath in all of the stories?
No, she's just in the one story about refusing to take a bath. There are 4 very different stories. Let's see, there's Molly McDougall, Bermuda Shorts, about a young man who gets a present he's not particularly fond of. Then there's one about keeping secrets. And the last one is about Fedora Flats, which is completely and utterly whimsical.
The keeping secrets, has that anything to do with, was there a frog involved in one of your stories? Or am I thinking of something
else?
Yes,
that was the frog, yes. When a big blue frog swallowed my brother, I did not tell my father or mother. I thought they would like to know, but I knew that they would worry, so.
Oh, beautiful.
I did not scream, I did not shout, I asked the frog to spit him out. So
that's beautiful. Yeah,
be careful about asking me to quote something.
I guess. any books of Dr. Seuss lying around maybe in your attic that might have inspired you?
It's funny. I tried to not be too Dr. Seussy, but obviously I didn't escape that. I guess there are worse people to be compared to.
Oh,
you want to have your own voice, but Dr. Seuss is pretty darn good too.
Absolutely,
so
beautiful.
I'll take that.
Absolutely, the 102 pages must have taken a while. George, did you concentrate on this after retirement? How long did it take to get this edited and ready for print?
You know, I always take a writing course, and I would periodically write children's stories. And it took about 5 years before I felt like I had enough children's stories to make a complete book. And that was when I went to Balboa Press to do the artwork. I had hoped to entice a friend to maybe do the artwork for me and split the profits, but it would have been quite a commitment, and I couldn't find anybody. I have plenty of friends who should be committed, but nobody wanted to commit to this project. So,
well, the illustrations are spectacular.
I was really pleased. I was really pleased.
Was that any complicated issue, or were they just able to just embrace the stories and run with it?
I guess they were. As a matter of fact, I was so pleased that I tried to call Balboa Press and talk directly to the person who did the artwork, but that's a no-no. So I just said, left a message, just, you know, tell him or her that I was very pleased.
It is very well done. The colors are great, and of course the characters are just amazing, and it ties in so beautifully with your stories. Was there any underlying message other than the fact that you wanted to have fun and make people laugh when you shared these stories?
Not really. If I inadvertently came up with any serious messages, I apologize. I wanted chuckles more than anything else.
Well, you've achieved it. And are there more stories in the pipeline? Are you going to release an additional follow-up book to this?
Well, if this does reasonably well, or at least well enough for me to get my investment back and maybe a few dollars more, there definitely will be a second book. I have four other stories that are in need of illustration So we'll just see how it goes.
Well, it's visually impressive and beautifully done. The stories are a lot of fun. I think children of any age, including old ones like me, would find this a great addition to their library. The title of the book, again, is Molly McDougal, Montgomery McGrath, and Other Stories to Make You Laugh. Our author, George Cooper. George, I need to get this in the hands of my listeners. How do they get a hold of it?
You know, I've got 16 books left, and I can't find one of them when I look for them, but here we go. I did find it. It's through Balboa Press, available at www.balboa.com.
Super. They can also do a search online under your name, George Cooper, just as it sounds.
That's right. That's right.
Amazon Press probably will carry this and several other locations. Their local bookseller can order it in by the author's name, George Cooper, and also by the title, Molly McDougal, Montgomery McGrath. That's a mouthful. Beautifully done. Best of luck with this in the future, and if things go well, I would love to visit with you again and share the follow-up book. I have a feeling is going to be coming out in the near future. Thanks for joining me today,
well,
George.
I hope so, Jay, and thank you, Jay.
Pleasure visiting with you. For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing. Join us again next week at noon Eastern.